Now, what about the patient with an adenocarcinoma who meets the entry criteria for the ECOG 4599 study looking at carboplatin and bevacizumab? How do you approach those patients, and do you think that chemocetuximab is an option in this situation?
I think chemocetuximab is an option, but at the same time, we do know that carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab led to a 2-month improvement in overall survival as compared to a somewhat less improvement in overall survival for the FLEX data. And as such, I think it's reasonable to think that bevacizumab is probably superior, though, you know, that's comparing cross trials and the usual caveats that apply. But that's also combined with our greater experience with administering bevacizumab for a large number of patients.
What's your take on the potential risks of bevacizumab to the patient with lung cancer, and how do you go through that with your patients?
I think that it's important to discuss these risks with patients because they're real and they can be quite dramatic if it occurs. I talk with all my patients about the risks of thromboembolic events with bevacizumab because I think that's an important one. You know, stroke is a debilitating side effect when it occurs, and as such, patients all need to hear about that.
What kind of numbers do you give to your patients?
You know, I think that I generally avoid specific numbers on this one because the data is not as well collated as it is perhaps for the colorectal cancer patient, but I think that I say in the single-digit percentages, patients are more likely to have stroke or heart attack or other events like that. And then I also talk with them about hemoptysis and fatal hemoptysis because that is an important cause of death with patients who are treated with bevacizumab. Those numbers are on the order of 3 to 5% is what I tell patients.
Are there any sort of risk factors for hemoptysis that you feel are useful to you in trying to sort through the risk?
Well, certainly squamous histology is a bad one, and evidence of cavitation of the tumor pre-treatment is also something that I look at and drives me away from using bevacizumab in that setting. I think that central tumor is one we talk about a lot, but it's not really well defined. I take a look at the scan. I look and see if there's a tumor sort of abutting large vessels that are important. And that's sort of my poor man's look at what a central tumor represents.
What's your experience been with other sort of more day-to-day side effects like hypertension and proteinuria?
Hypertension hasn't been, to my mind, a relatively significant problem. I think it occurs, certainly, but most of us are board-certified internists, and I think we can try to manage hypertension at least a little bit. And there's such a wide variety of antihypertensives out there that we can certainly choose one and begin that therapy. As we were taught back in internal medicine residency programs, I've decided to pick a class of agents and become comfortable with one or two agents within that class as my first-line therapy for hypertension.
What about the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib, either those two agents just together or with chemotherapy, particularly in the patient who has EGFR mutation or a non-smoker?
I think that the benefits of erlotinib in patients with epidermal growth factor receptor mutations are clear, and I don't know that the addition of bevacizumab to erlotinib makes a significant improvement in either the response rate, time to progression, or overall survival. And as such, I steer away from using bevacizumab in that setting, and I use erlotinib as a single agent there. I think that in the patient who maybe has some clinical characteristics that suggest they're going to respond, or in a patient that you're treating upfront with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, it's reasonable to add on erlotinib to that. I generally, in an off-study situation, have not been treating patients with erlotinib and bevacizumab, either upfront or in the second or third line.